From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Rwandan hotelier and humanitarian who protected over 1,200 of his countrymen during the height of the 1994 Rwandan genocide is now facing trial under Paul Kagame's government. Paul Rusesabagina is the author of An Ordinary Man, an autobiography, and founder of the Hotel Rwanda Rusesabagina Foundation. He's been widely lauded for his critical life-saving work and been recognized internationally, including receiving the United States Presidential Medal of Freedom. He's used his celebrity to continue doing humanitarian work, but also speaking out against abuses by President Kagame. Last year, Rusesabagina was arrested while outside Rwanda and brought back to the country for a trial on trumped-up charges that include murder, armed robbery, and terrorism. Mr. Rusesabagina is currently a citizen of Belgium, and his lawyers say he's been denied due process and is also in ill health. In April 2014, I spoke with a man whose story is told in the film Hotel Rwanda. It was the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. Today, we re-air that interview in light of his current plight. The explanations for why what happened in 1994 happened generally tend to be fairly reductive, that ethnic tensions from centuries ago between these two distinct groups led to this genocide. But in fact, in your book, you explain that Hutus and Tutsis are not very easily distinguished and that there were a lot of outside forces fanning the flames. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Of course I can. First of all, Hutus and Tutsis do not hate each other as many people tend to make it to use it. However, there are a few reasons why people do kill people. One of those reasons is when the leaders, when the country's leadership use ethnicity in order to divide and rule. And this has been going on in Rwanda for the last many years, if not centuries. Secondly, when people are very hungry and you tell them to do what their parents did and they were not punished, so it becomes easy to do it. For example, in Rwanda, in 1959, 60, 61, 73, 1990, when some Rwandans went to exile, many other Rwandans took over their properties, and those people were not punished. So impunity is one of those factors that encourage people to kill people, to make them flee the country and go to exile. And also, besides that, Rwanda has a special problem. In Rwanda, there is a problem of land. Rwanda is one of the most overpopulated countries on earth. Therefore, this country being that populated, without land, kids, young people, younger generations having nothing else to do, even not farming, so it also becomes, and hungry, it also becomes a problem. There is hunger in the country. So if you see all of those elements combined, encourage, make Rwanda what it is today, encourages Rwandans to kill Rwandans.
Hmm. Well, tell us about the role that this radio station's private radio station played in the genocide. And it sort of speaks to the power that media have to influence people's actions.
If you now, thank you for talking about my autobiography. If you read my autobiography, you notice that I give a very important role to words. In 1994, when I was using my words, trying to save lives, the media were using words, the radio, RTLM, using words to kill lives, and they succeeded. Killing in 1994 in Rwanda became a job. Killing, but the media were urging people to go into neighbors' roofs, look for so and so, kill them. They were using words to smear their neighbors, calling them cockroaches, so that killing is not more killing human beings, but removing infestation. So you can imagine dehumanizing also people before they kill them. So this is what was going on in Rwanda before 1994, during actually the war, because we were in a civil war. And this is also what was being said during the climax of the war, which became the Rwandan genocide.
Now, let's talk about why there was no international intervention. There was, many people, including yourself, were calling for help while you were holding down the fort at your hotel, protecting these hundreds of people. You were calling the White House. You were calling the United Nations. And the United Nations did have a force in Rwanda, most of whom were essentially evacuated, leaving Rwandans behind. But a very small force remained. Why did nobody do anything?
Well, I think that, first of all, the international community does not really care for Africa. It is sad to say, but this is also a fact. Secondly, there was another event which was going on in South Africa. 1994 was the time when South Africans were getting rid of apartheid. So that also attracted the international community's attention. However, as we all know, in 1993, the United States had been ashamed in Somalia with the Black Hawk down. Therefore, that kind of fear and shame, they also feared it. And the Rwandan army at that time was smart enough to slaughter 10 Belgian soldiers from the UN peacekeeping force. And when they were killed, that is when then the international community immediately decided to run away, and we saw them abandoning us.
Right. You describe in your book how Rwandan refugees had gathered at a UN compound, and when the UN soldiers were being evacuated, so many of them knew that that was it, that once these foreign troops left, then there would be no place for refuge. Churches were turned into a refuge. And there's a famous church in Rwanda that today is a memorial for the genocide. How is it that in all of this, where places of refuge became, came under attack, that your hotel remained a refuge that managed to keep over 1,200 people alive?
Well, traditionally, Rwandans have been killing each other. And each and every time when this happened, people were fleeing to churches because they believed that the churches were supposed to protect them in a way or another. But surprisingly, during the Rwandan genocide of 1994, the churches were among the places where people were being hacked to death, cut into pieces. However, some of them who came, who happened to flee to my hotel, 1,268 of them, we happened to all of us get out safe. No one killed, no one injured, no one even bitten. Why? Because once God intervened and made a miracle. But secondly, sometimes, as we say in Kinyarwanda, also God needs to be helped. So through words, I was negotiating with each and everyone and treating them as friends, whether they were friends or not friends. But our mission was that one of keeping your friends close and your enemies closer so that you know what is next. Third, I had stockpiled a few favors here and there throughout my whole life, treating people accordingly. And then when time, that is more or less like putting some money in a bank. You keep putting in a few coins, and when time comes for you to cash them in, you cash them in. So all the favors I had stockpiled during those years of my career, I cashed them, and I borrowed heavily, as we read in An Ordinary Man, my autobiography. Fourth, of course, in Rwanda, we believe that men can never sit down around a table without a drink. And as we say that, it is not corruption. It is a habit of Rwandans. So I believe that also helped, because I invited each and everyone to the table whenever it was an opportunity or why not. I knew that all my stocks were supposed to be looted. Why not giving them out myself, by myself? I also did that, and it helped to save lives. And also, words are not enough. I also had a kind of instrument to convey my words. This was a working phone.
Yeah.
So with my working phone, I happened to convey my message to call the international community.
You said you used words throughout to try to save these 1,200 people as the killing was happening. But words are also weapons that the international community used. As the killings were happening, as these 800,000 lives were being taken away in the span of just 100 days, the international community worked very hard to not use the one word, which was genocide. And you shared how the U.S. State Department made a very bizarre declaration where they said acts of genocide may have occurred. And spokeswoman Christine Shelley was then asked how many acts of genocide it takes to equal a genocide. How important is that word when we talk about things that are happening today? Some people, for example, have said that it applies to places like Syria or to the Central African Republic. It's a very, very strong word.
Well, I think that the international community sometimes do not use their words because mostly they do not want to be involved. And they pretend, they just kind of pretend to close eyes and ears. They pretend to kind of turn away, turn their backs, and don't see, so that they show that they are not concerned and they are not informed, not aware. However, if they could have used words, and honestly, saving lives is possible. In Syria, they can save, they can use words. They don't need to use weapons. In the Congo, which is more or less forgotten,
right,
where more than 7 million have been killed.
Yes.
Hundreds of thousands of women have been raped. It is a matter of telling all those countries, entertaining proxy militias, which are going into that country just to steal, to loot minerals. It is a matter of telling them to stop when we know them. We know it is Rwanda and Uganda. It is a matter of the United States telling Rwanda, because everybody knows that the Rwandan government is a U.S. ally. Why don't we tell them that, listen, openly, stop what you're doing in the Congo? One of the proxy militias was kicked out. This is the M23. But very soon, it has been changing names. Very soon, it might change and get a new name. So I think that each and every kind of African dictatorship has always a Western superpower pulling the strings, manipulating what we see on the screen, It is a matter then of telling those allies to stop, and they will.
Now, Paul, you are living in Brussels, but you are Rwandan. You love your country, as you describe in your book. And the genocide is over. There is supposed to have been peace, reconciliation, justice. Why are you not in Rwanda? And has there, in fact, been justice?
Well, why am I not in Rwanda? That is the whole issue.
Hmm.
In 1994, in July, when the Tutsi rebels took over the country, I did not leave the country as Ote Rwanda portrays. I rather reopened the Mikolin Hotel and the Diplomat Hotel, both on July 15th, and started operating. But the newcomers, the conquerors, wanted each and everything. Being a general manager in a company, it was not allowed, especially when you had not contributed to the war, when you had never been very active in this and that, when you were from one side and not the other one. So on September 5th, 1996, I was almost killed and escaped by luck. When I escaped, I had gone through a lot of things. I had seen the war when it started in 1990. I had been going through it, went through the genocide, and had a belief that we're going to rebuild a new Rwanda. According to the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the Tutsi Rebels movement, that Rwanda was supposed to be a new paradise on earth. This is what they promised everybody. But we saw them now tying people from the back, beating their chests, breaking them, burning them. We saw them now destroying a camp with machine guns on the ground and helicopter bombardments. We saw hundreds of thousands of people being put into prisons without any good reason, without trials, for 6 years. Justice not really going on. And then I said to myself that enough was enough. I also ended up going into exile, the exile that I had hated throughout my whole life. Another thing that I had been fighting against. So I came to Belgium, and I thought that one day maybe justice would be done. A few years later, we saw the international community opening a court to try and convict Hutus who committed the genocide. And we knew purposely that the Rwandan genocide took place during a civil war when and where both sides, Hutus and Tutsis, were butchering each other. And only Hutus who committed the genocide were being tried and convicted. We saw war criminals, well known, who had killed thousands and thousands of refugees in the Congo, who had raped women. We saw them now trying and convicting Hutus who committed the genocide. Now, how in the name of justice would a criminal try and convict another criminal? So justice is still a problem. Human rights are still a problem in the country. Will you see that political space does no more exist? There is no freedom of speech, no freedom of media. People even today are being put into prisons, some of them being followed into exile and assassinated. And this is what we saw with the Colonel Karegeya Patrick about 3 months ago in Johannesburg on the New Year's Eve. His colleague, they tried to kill him, Kayumba, General Kayumba, they tried to kill him. And so far they haven't had his life. Three times, we never know, maybe one day they also get hold of his life. They were among a list of only of five people, most enemies of the president, and I'm one of those ones.
You're one of the enemies of the president?
Oh, yeah. Well, if you see if you go on YouTube and write what they call Ibigarasha, you will notice that I'm number one. General Kayumba is number two. Karegeya, who was killed in South Africa, is number three. And Rudasingwa is number four, and Gahima number five.
You who were helping to save people against the genocide, who were trying to call the attention of the international community to stop the genocide, are today considered an enemy by the president of Rwanda, the leader of the rebel forces during that time 20 years ago. So that certainly is an indication of how far things have come or not come. I'm wondering, Paul, if you are in touch with the people that you helped keep alive, with any of them, and what your conversations are like these days, 20 years later, about that horrific time.
Some of them we meet very often, because whenever they travel to Europe and America, they always make sure that we meet, sit down, chat, remember the past, and sometimes remember, commemorate together. Even those kids I was taking here and there, bringing them to my home, some of them we meet very often. And we talk. You were wondering, how can one who stood up for what he or she believed in 1994 denounced openly the genocide and fought against it, cannot be in his or her country? I will let you know that the very day you still stand and speak out, you always become, when you say what people don't want to be said, you always become their enemy. Unless you do what they want, otherwise you'll never be a good guy. So whenever the Rwandan government kills so-and-so, I always get out a press release. Whenever they put in prison this one and that one, I always speak out about this, and I think that in 1994, when I had guns on my head and I did what I believed I was supposed to do, and no one killed me, today I live in the West, where there is a freedom of speech, where people, human beings are supposed to be respected as human beings. So why should I shut up? And whereas the Rwandan government follows us even in exile and tries to silence us. Do you have heard about this? Because you have heard about what happened with the Scotland Yard when they warned two Rwandans that the Rwandan diplomats were spying on them and wanted to kill them. These people had to be protected.
Paul, I want to thank you so much for everything you do, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Paul Rusesa Bagina is the author of An Ordinary Man, an autobiography, and also founder of the Hotel Rwanda Rusesa Bagina Foundation. His story is told in the popular film Hotel Rwanda about how he saved more than 1,200 Hutus and Tutsis from genocide in 1994. Mr. Rusesa Bagina currently faces a political trial in Rwanda over his outspoken criticism of President Paul Kagame. The interview we just aired was one I did with him in 2014. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.